Welcome to episode 3 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Each episode, we bring you the ancient mythologies of the Arabian Nights as reinterpreted by modern authors. This week, we feature stories by Tim Leahy and Mircea Eluppu. The stories are famously told by Scheherazade to enrapture the Sultan in a heroic effort to forestall her execution and save her people. Just in case you need a reminder, on the first night, Scheherazade began the tale of the traitor and the djinn, telling the Sultan how the wealthy bond trader came to find himself waiting in a strange dreamscape for a demon to claim his life. The dark creature was stopped, however, when the first of three old men offered to swap his story for a third of the bond trader's flesh and blood. On the second night, the first old man finished his tale of witchcraft and woe, when the second old man offered the same bargain, to swap his tale for a third of the bond trader's life. So, the second old man began to tell in fragmented but rich language of his final season as the theater director in a small town, and how the rich and careless Frome brothers co-opted his stage to put on their own amateur works. We were just about to discover how the plays were received when dawn came and Scheherazade ceased telling her tale. The Sultan, however, was so enraptured by her story that he allowed Scheherazade to live for one more day so that she may finish it the following evening. And so we come to the third night. We find Scheherazade and the Sultan together in the royal bedchambers, after having taken their evening meal and drunk their fill of strong wine.
Would it please you to hear more of the story, my love?
Scheherazade asked, and the Sultan nodded, for the night weighed heavy on his soul.
Then let me continue the tale of the traitor and the djinn, and pick up the story of the second old man and the two gray dogs.
And thus she began.
In short, the plays went very poorly because they were very bad. Each was a bigger disgrace than the last, and there were three of them to endure. I pleaded as hard as I could to discourage their perseverance. By the last production, there was hardly an audience to suffer or jeer. It was not that I feared for my reputation. Our town can neither form nor demolish reputations in the arts. Rather, it was the fact that each failure caused the brothers greater pain and disappointment. I felt an unexplainable sympathy with the objects of my scorn. Here they were, somewhat callous aristocrats caught in a moment of striving. They were not artists, true, but there was nothing, it occurred to me, that said they couldn't write a play worth seeing. I, their newly employed dramaturg, accompanied them westward. We rode in a first-class compartment. The two gray hunting dogs lay sprawled across from me. It wasn't all bad, and it might someday be all good, I kept thinking. I am thinking. Neither the moment nor the audience was right. The whims of the spectator are well known. Each house has a different set of eyes. We can count on others, I told them. Other minds will conspire to give us our due. We will suffer through our own season of fame soon enough. The scenery outside changed, and the mild hills through which the train snaked gave way to a suggestion of desert. We looked upon this vista, uncertain whether it meant a new itinerary. A dark sand whirled about the train as we now sped in between rows of perfectly symmetrical strangler figs. Bare roots engulfed us. The sky, no longer a stage for thunder, was curtained in a still black while the moon had taken the kind of leave only conceivable in dreams. I kept thinking. It wasn't all bad, and it might someday all be good. The train pulled into a station. A station, I call it, because where else does a train stop? The dogs loped out down the metal steps and onto the dusty ground, and I plodded after them at the brothers' nodded orders. Really, there was nothing there. A shack, a broken window, a fractured old man. But the dogs walked on, out away from the train into the sand, the falsely misted flatland. And the train sounded illustrious cheers of metal, and I was too far. What's more, the dogs were unconcerned. So the train pulled away, revealing even greater absence. And the beasts simply headed into the waste, and I hobbled after them, watching as their small prints were kissed away by the blowing sand. As I walked, and as I made my way to this place, I remember the monologue where Ricky, a 12-year-old drunk in the Frome's last play, Death to My Family, addresses the audience.
And the wine came, and I never refused the wine. A fine Marcelin turns you from cavorting into a deeper or weepy dementedness. And so I skated through my unlit home, trampling over temporary hindrances without much regard for pain or inflicted damage. You could do this where I live because the floors are all slick parquet. You could skate real sad, real drunk, and real stupid when no one's home. If you get the chance, play Liszt, turn the lights low, scour my father's wine cellar for a bit, and glide around the abandoned premises. It helps if you wear cashmere socks and skates. These can be found in the second drawer on the right side of my parents' bed. Otherwise, what I can tell you, keep your head low and your tears to a minimum. Watch out for my mother's sculptures. The one of the leopard is worth a bunch. And be wary of any signs that the proprietors are returning. You have to look decent then. The wine will have colored your lips red and you might have toppled a vase or two. Embalm yourself in the vase water perfume. Lie on the divan. Look decent and tell them I gave you the keys. It will be my father who will give you a tough time. When the second old man finished speaking, the two gray dogs sitting patiently at his side, the dark human form flexed and trembled. "Very well," it pronounced in its thunderous voice. "You may take a third of this traitor's flesh and blood in return for your story, for it feeds me as he could not. But now I will claim what is left of this creature for my own and be on my way." The towering dark form stretched out a terrible arm to the bond trader, who cowered back away from the black, finger-like forms. The third old man did not stand as he spoke. "Stay, fiend. Stay your hasty hand and listen to this old man's tale, for he has a story more valuable than the head and shoulders of this man. I will trade you this story for the remaining portion of the trader." The dark arm widened and flickered, but slowly withdrew. "I will offer you the same bargain, then," said the shape. And so, the ancient man fell into a deep reflection and began to tell his tale. So profound and clear was his memory, it was as if everyone present was there to witness. How similar the expression of contempt is to disgust. In fact, let's put image 211 side by side with 220. Myra, can you please drag them? Yeah, great. Okay, let's begin by identifying the shared qualities.
Professor David Malmsteen was eager for class to end on this lusty vernal afternoon. It was late March, and he was teaching his favorite material, his calling, really, to a bright and interested group of students. But the professor had an important appointment after class. Looking to cap a lengthy and physically exhausting career in the State Department with less strenuous work, David pivoted his experience into a teaching position at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. Handsome at 58, the professor was considered past his prime in the Foreign Service, and a has-been by the younger officers. But in academia, he was welcomed as a novitiate, rich with ideas and more vigorous than his tenured colleagues. It was one of those elegant transitions in life that David embodied with an unaffected ease. Yes, Simone. In both slides, you see the subject with pinched upper lips, like a string were lifting the labium superius up to the crown of the nose and in toward the philtrum. Excellent observation, Simone. What else, class? The course was called Analysis of Facial Microexpressions, Human Physiognomy in Negotiation and Diplomacy. David taught two other graduate courses closely related to the topic. His ability to read people's intentions, no matter how obscure, was notorious in the Foreign Service. It was uncanny how he could expose a motive or develop a bargaining position just by giving close attention to the expressions of his adversaries. Both faces have crumpled temples, revealing crow's feet in this subject in particular. Very good. And the final major similarity, Alexa. Exposed teeth. In both profiles, the subject bares her teeth because of the elevated upper lip and contracted buccinator muscles. It seems that everyone has been giving the reading close attention. I'm very pleased with you all. After we come back from the break, be prepared to discuss the crucial differences between contempt and disgust, both in their physical traits, as well as the implications for dispute, resolution, negotiation, and diplomacy. In the reading, that means going through Chapter 8 and Assignment 12 of the syllabus. And with that, the class departed. David busily packed up his things and locked up the classroom only moments after everyone had left. He was eager to get to the jeweler where his wife's anniversary gift was waiting for pickup. The professor had commissioned a custom set of earrings, in silver, for his 25th anniversary with Colette. The actual day of their anniversary was 1 week from today, but he wanted to genuinely surprise his wife, and they would have much more time to enjoy together now that school was out for a 4-day holiday weekend. The plan was to bring his wife to her favorite West Village jazz club and then walk her to Washington Square Park, to give her the present in the same spot where he had proposed to her so many years before. The jeweler's shop was an unkempt hole in the wall in the Lower East Side. Not in a million years would David have commissioned such an expensive and meaningful gift here, but for the strong insistence of a friend who knew about such things. Worse than the clustered, dusty, and arcane appearance of her shop was the demeanor of the jeweler herself. She was wily, with one lazy eye flanked by a winter harvest of greasy hair. The age of the woman was indeterminable. She had the appearance of someone ancient beyond the counting of years, but with a crazed glow in her face demonstrable only by youth. For a master of reading people's faces, this woman was entirely obscure to David. After a perfunctory acknowledgement that he had arrived for pickup, the decrepit hag of a jeweler shuffled into the back of her store through a beaded curtain. David glanced around the shop to take note of strange books lying around with pages open to fantastical illustrations, unidentifiable dried plants hanging pinned in a corner, and peculiar trinkets of what he guessed to be Middle Eastern origin.
Uxor tuna est asinus.
The voice sounded just over David's shoulder, and he gave an astonished yelp. The old hag had reappeared right behind him, seemingly from nowhere.
Sorry, but what?
That will be $350, please.
David would have probed into the cryptic and unwelcomed utterance, but he'd had enough of this jeweler and her musty grotto. The store felt like it was getting smaller, and her one good eye had the sensation of a flame on his skin. He paid quickly, with cash he'd withdrawn beforehand. Professor Malmsteen opened the door to leave, the bells ringing gently, when he heard her address him. This time with a clarity and youthfulness that was entirely new and eerie, as if spoken by someone possessed.
So good, even on an unworthy soil, for it will not be lost, whatever it is sown.
And with that, David left. His ride home on the A train was fraught with shivers. He tried to focus on Colette, how fine she would look tonight in the park. But his skin kept creeping as if subject to the old hag's igneous gaze. Are you feeling all right, Professor? David was not feeling all right. He felt like a dog. The last week had been a miserable one with excess liquor and very little sleep. He was redolent of booze and flashed vacant eyes at Simone, his favorite student. She requested that they meet to discuss her recent paper, and because they had rapport and the weather was nice, they convened at a cafe on Morningside Drive. Evading the inquiry, David asked her to elaborate on the crux of her assignment, which the professor read but was unable to focus on. Surely the main difference between contempt and disgust lies in the eyes. With disgust, the eyes are squinted and self-involved, revealing the internal and largely sensorial nature of the emotion. Even in instances where the eyes remain open, it's usually only in the context of fear, as someone would look at vomit with disgust in order to avoid it. David stared with barren eyes into his coffee. She considered that he may be pondering her line of thought, but the more obvious answer was that his mind was somewhere else. Courteously, she continued. But with contempt, the eyes give as much as they receive. It's a system that fuels itself. You see, when someone holds contempt for something or someone, they're absolutely fixated on it. The object of contempt, when immediately visible, is like kerosene for a fire, and it exaggerates the maxillofacial tells. That's the taking half. But the giving is just as important. Disgust is self-involved, as I said, but contempt has a transitive quality. It projects. It forces itself onto the object of loathing and changes it. Contempt has the intention of making something ugly. In the ebony depths of his coffee, David relived the events following his trip to the jeweler. He recalled walking up to his apartment, instead of taking the elevator, just to rehearse the lines he'd prepared for Colette. He remembered music coming from the apartment, loud, and thinking how out of character it was that his wife would have such modern synthetic music playing. She had no taste for anything other than 1950s jazz. David only saw her face through the crook of the man's elbow when he opened the bedroom door. Because of the music, they must not have heard him come into the apartment. They reacted with fear, embarrassment, shame. It was a typical scene for these kinds of revelations. But David just stood there for a moment, mute. He then placed the bouquet of flowers, bottle of wine, and earrings on the dining room table and left, not having uttered a single word.
However, at that very moment, Scheherazade perceived the dawn of day and ceased saying her permitted say.
Ah, But I see the light of day is dawning outside the bedroom, and my execution is nearly at hand. I suppose you will never know what became of the third old man or befell the poor bond trader.
But the Sultan was so enraptured by Scheherazade's story that he allowed her to live for one more day so that she could finish the tale the following night. The 1001 Nights podcast is produced by Morgan Dubin and me, Nathan Kane. Scheherazade is played by the wonderful Ariel Siegel. Tonight's stories were written by Marcia Lupu and Tim Leahy. Tim Leahy, who wrote the story of the third old man and the mule, is a writer and musician living in New York City. Tonight's music was contributed by Pharaoh's Daughter, Hey Van Laura Lemmy, and Damscray. If you'd like to find out more, visit us online at 1001nightspodcast.com. There you can find links to the full text of the stories you heard tonight, as well as links to the original tales of the 1001 Nights. You'll also find information about how to submit your own stories to the podcast. For more updates, follow us on Twitter or sign up for our newsletter on our website. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, please consider rating, reviewing, or subscribing to the podcast in the iTunes Store. After all, as we heard tonight,
so good, even on an unworthy soil. For it will not be lost, wherever it is sown.
All right, that will do it for episode 3. Thank you so much for listening, and good morning. You're not